All right. So thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's good to talk to you. Gosh, I mean, we're practically neighbors, and I think this is the first time we've actually had voice communication.
Yes, it is. It is. And that's one of the interesting and troubling things about this whole business. So I hope it's not the last time.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. So what I'm hoping to do, Nathan, is record our conversation. I'd like to make the full conversation available to you and to whomever you want to do or whatever you want to do with it. If nothing, that's fine too. I'll release the whole conversation as part of my presentation, and then I'm going to be cutting together your conversation with a few others into the formal, air quotes here, K-12 online presentation. And so folks will have access to all of these conversation strands. Again, not trying to answer anything as much as provide some fodder for discussion for folks who are trying to figure out what online community means and what educational communities are and those type of things. So I'm assuming I have your permission to record this.
Excellent. Will there be a text-based discussion someplace afterwards that we can that I can help contribute to?
That's a really good question, and I don't know if that makes sense. Actually, it certainly makes sense. There'll certainly be a comments thread to the K-12 presentation,
Oh, that'll work.
and then as I release the audio, the full audio pieces, I'll probably release them as separate posts on my blog, so there'll be a place there as well.
Okay, cool.
Will that work?
Yeah.
Excellent, excellent. So, we're recording, and let's get right into it. To start the formal conversation, Nathan, tell us who you are, what you do, and how we know each other.
My name is Nathan Lowell. I am the Technologies Coordinator for the National Center on Severe and Sensory Disabilities at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley, Colorado. I'm also a half-time professor at Morehead State University in Morehead, Kentucky, teaching educational technology. And in my copious spare seconds, I'm a novelist. I write audiobook novels, that is, I write novels that are then turned into serial audio downloads for people to subscribe to. You and I know each other from a variety of different places. We've met on Twitter. We have met in numerous conversations in other places and other times. We've talked about issues of writing, of community, of the nature of education. And we are apparently, although we have never confirmed this in the flesh, practically neighbors.
Yeah, you were mentioning just before I hit record that we live literally in the next town over. You're in Greeley, I'm in Fort Collins, is that right? And we've never talked before today. Uh-oh, have I lost
Yeah,
you?
just down the street.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
Yep.
well, we keep cutting in and out. I'm not sure what the if it's Skype or wherever the problem lies, but
Yeah,
I'm
I'm
still
sorry.
here.
Okay, good. Good. Excellent. So, the reason I wanted to talk to you today is I know that you think a lot about, and you mentioned this, online community and what it means for learning and what it means for teaching. And I just sort of wanted to tease out some of your thoughts and experiences for the benefit of folks who, primarily, I think the K-12 online audience are just sort of starting to dabble or get their feet wet in online community. And I thought that would be interesting. The name of my presentation is The Lie of Community. And I called it that because I think that there are a lot of misunderstandings about the nature of, first of all, I think community online or off, but online specifically. And I was hoping we could talk a little bit about that.
I like this. I like this title because it's evocative. To throw some background on this, I've been dealing in online communities since about 94. Yeah, 94, 95, I started getting into online communities that were not strictly asynchronous. It's important to recognize that we have a tyranny of synchrony, and that's that we tend to think that if we're not there at the same time, we're not there at all, and that's, of course, ludicrous.
Yeah,
But,
say,
anyway, I mean,
go ahead.
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you to say more about that synchrony distinction.
Well, because teachers are engaged in a classroom, we're trained to talk to the people who are with us at the time they are with us. And so conversations that happen via email, which are asynchronous, conversations that happen via bulletin board or via discussion board, which are asynchronous, tend to be looked at as somehow inferior because they're not occurring synchronously. That is, we are not all in the same room at the same time. Now, whether the room is a literal room, that is a classroom, room 302 in some school somewhere, or a living room, or whether they're virtual in a chat room or in a virtual space like Second Life or wherever they might be, a gaming environment, a mud space, whatever, we tend to view, I think we have a bot. I think many people, I'm not going to say everybody, and I don't have any, I wish I had some data, but I believe a significant bias toward the synchronous. And I think that's to the detriment, particularly of education, where most learning happens in an asynchronous mode. We do not learn in a group.
Well, that begs a question, Nathan. How do we learn?
Well, I may have to rephrase that. We don't necessarily learn in real time together. One of the courses that I teach is distance education, and one of the examples, one of the things that I talk about in my course, is Keegan's distinction that distance education happens when the teacher and the learner are separate, at least for part of the process. Now, I've got a whole bunch of problems with Keegan's definition to begin with, but I have a particular problem with that one in that it's not diagnosed situation, a classroom-based course where for 3 hours on Thursday you go to a room and you all sit down together. The majority of learning does not happen in that room. It happens as a result of being in that room, but it happens later. The example that I use is a textbook. Now, a textbook, when assigned in a classroom course, of course, is a traditional kind of instructional strategy. But when assigned in an online course, it's now a distance strategy. Now, why is that? What's different about that particular technology? It's still asynchronous. That is, typically, one does not read the textbook in class. One gets an assignment to read the textbook. And later, we come together, perhaps, to reinforce, revisit, offer explanation or interpretation of what happened. But I would maintain that the learning does not, at least not exclusively, happen in that synchronous conflagration, but later, or even earlier, during reflection on the actual instructional content. And that by having this bias toward the synchronous, by looking at, in particular, I'm looking at online educational environments that emphasize the synchronous. The fact that you and I are having this conversation in real time has value because we're feeding off each other and able to compress this conversation into a very short period of time. We could have done this in any other mode. We could have done this in an asynchronous mode. We could have done this in a text mode. We could have done this via email, for that matter. But we would have lost a certain sense of immediacy. The immediacy is what's important for synchrony. It's not necessarily the information transfer.
Yeah, and in fact, we have had similar conversations over time asynchronously, which is where I've learned a lot about where, well, it's where you've helped me think about the nature of community and the nature of learning as it happens in community. You teach a lot of folks across a lot of distance, and you have written extensively on the nature of community. I want to talk about a post you wrote a while back, actually. In internet time, it's ancient. The post is called Old Cognitive Dissonance. Can you talk about that post?
Well, Old Cognitive Dissonance is the name of the blog. Which one? On Community?
Oh, excuse
or
me. On Context. Forgive me. On Context.
Comes from the idea of zone proximal development. I was teaching a class of teachers who were not familiar with the term zone proximal development. And so I put together a little explanation of what zone of proximal development is. And then I thought about what that meant in terms of education. Context is individual. In schools, we tend to act as if context is universal. But context is specific to an individual. And it's from the inside looking out. There is a global context. But the reality of that context is that's interpreted through the filter of the learner context. And the learner context does not include everything that's in the global context. I don't know what's happening, for example, right now in Paraguay. So the global context includes Paraguay. My personal context does not. So what happens is, as a learner, what you do is you kind of create an archive. And this is just sort of a theoretical idea. The learner creates an archive that's constructed from their context. And as a result, what happens is that they're able to draw on the ideas that they have archived. So even though I might have context, I might have in my archive what it was like to be a dragger boy on a fishing boat off the coast of Maine when I was 17 years old, that's no longer in my context here in Colorado. Although it is in my archive, so that I can pull from that. I can pull from the sights, the sounds, the smells, the experiences that occur to me in that context at this other time, because I have it in my archive. Now, the challenge then for teacher, or the challenge for a learner, is to add to context and through context into archive things that they need to know going forward. For example, one of the things that I needed to know when we moved to Colorado was how to buy a house in Colorado. Now, while I knew how to buy a house in Maine and I knew how to buy a house in New York, I did not know how to buy a house in Colorado. It's a very different experience. So I had to learn that. And in order to learn that, I needed to add that cognate. I needed to add that domain to my context. I did that by moving to Colorado and finding a real estate agent who could instruct me in how the ins and outs of that process worked. So from a certain standpoint, the global context contains a whole infinity, perhaps, of ideas, of information domains, of what I call in this post cognates, that are only available to me if they impinge somehow on my context, if they are made aware, if I am made aware of them by having them infringe on my zone of proximal development. I can't know of anything that I don't know exists. As soon as I know it exists, now I have leverage to find out something about it. So I need some sort of leverage in order to allow these contexts, I'm sorry, to allow these cognates to connect to me somehow. And I view that bridge idea as one of the key roles of a teacher. Now, a teacher and a learner have an overlapping context. Typically, it's a course. Now, it may be something more than a course, but at least it's a course. So if I show up in a particular course, whether it's an online course or a classroom course or whatever, I'm in the same place with and am sharing a context with another individual who has a separate LEN overlap. That provides an information flow, that provides an opportunity for me to interact with this other context. And for the individual in that context, the teacher, to share with me facets of their archive, ideas in their context, and cognates with which they have familiarity, and allows me to get access to them, to add them to my context by at least archiving them later.
Oh, I'm here.
Yep, that's it.
Good. I lost you for just a second on the end. So let me clarify. The purpose then of a teacher in this model is to be that bridge, to be that network, or to be a piece of a network, to bring the word network back into it, between the learner and either the stuff,
right,
or the idea.
Right. The purpose of a teacher is to provide the link to an idea.
Yeah, and so then the purpose of my, say, online community or my learning network, as one of the buzzy words has or buzz phrases is to help me know that which it is I do not know?
Right. I'm convinced that the purpose of the network, particularly the personal learning network or personal learning environment, is to have the right number of connections to the right contexts. And the challenge is to have sufficient variety in those connections. I think Downs has written about this a lot. So has Will Richardson, about how who you listen to is very important. And if you only listen to the same people or the same group of people, then you're likely to miss out on important conversations that are happening elsewhere outside of that. And what happens is your network becomes an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm. You said something I want to follow up on. You said the right number of connections or the right number of people. How do you decide,
right.
How does one decide what that right number is?
I think it's a question of fluency. I think it's a question of how comfortable you are in using the tools. Now, if I gave my network to somebody who wasn't particularly fluent in this environment, they would be immediately overwhelmed and shut down.
Mm-hmm.
To give you an idea of what my environment is like, I follow about 550 people who also follow me on Twitter. My aggregator is, I think it just went over 500 feeds again. That's a lot. Even for aficionados, 500 people in a blog aggregator is a tad on the egregious side. My email is almost entirely listserv traffic. I follow about 8 or 9 relatively active listservs. I get on average, and this is a rough guess, and it depends on how closely I follow, but I will get anywhere from 300 to 600 messages in my aggregator every day. I'll get another 300 messages in my email every day. Depending on how long I stay on Twitter, there may be thousands of messages, thousands of tweets that come across on Twitter.
So, do you read all of those?
They haven't been. But the idea is that I have at least the option to read or not. I at least have the option to see what topics are creating churn, what topics are being discussed in various places around the web.
So how does a new teacher, or not necessarily a new teacher, but somebody new to this idea of building a network, what do they do? I mean, should they grab... Go ahead.
I think the first thing they need to do is grab a gator. Google Reader is pretty good, I guess. I don't use Google Reader. I use a Linux-based one that's on my laptop because my laptop is always with me. For teachers that are moving around from computer to computer, web-based aggregator is probably a good choice. And I would suggest that somebody new in the space, pick, oh, I'm going to say no more than 50 feeds. Probably 20 would be better. But do something rash, like follow half a dozen educators, and then follow an international news feed. In fact, follow a couple of international news feeds. I follow Al Jazeera and BBC, and I also subscribe to Reuters. So I get a lot of what's U.S.-based news, but I get a lot of what's not U.S.-based news. The Beeb is good for international scientific stuff. They have a lot of good stuff. Follow a political blog. I'm not sick, and there are a lot of elementary school teachers who will have a problem with some of the language and some of the ideas, but it's important to expose yourself to ideas that are not yours. One of the problems that we have is if we only listen to people who think like us, we're not really exposed to ideas that might enrich our own thinking. Follow Stephen Downes. You want an anti-voice. Follow Stephen Downes. Follow Dave Weiner. Follow people who are engaged in technology and politics in a way that is really not the educational view of politics and technology and politics. And I think if you start by reading, Bill Richardson is always on about this, blogging is not journaling, and I agree with him. If you don't have anything to read, if you're not reading anything, you don't have anything to write about. And if you don't write about anything, which is the next step, you do need to have a blog. You do need to write about stuff. Because until you write about it, you don't really know what you think about it. You don't really take that extra step of reflection. There's a reason that the obligatory construct notebook is required in every constructivist course. You need to write down what you think in order to find out what it is. You can sit around and think about it all day long, but until you try to articulate it, until you try to put it into words, until you try to explain it to somebody else, even if nobody else is really reading it, then you don't really know what you think. And so for a new teacher, for somebody new to this space, for somebody first creating their personal learning network, get a gator, pick an aggregator, and then subscribe to a few of the louder voices. Yours is a good one. From an education standpoint, I read you, I read Cool Cat Teacher, I read Will Richardson, I read, I'd have to bring up my gator now to look at it because there's so many. But from an educational standpoint, particularly the K-12 environment, you guys are the ones that I'm following all the time. Cheryl Nussbaum Beach. Follow somebody who's not a K-12 teacher. Follow Stephen Downes, who's dealing with distance education, aggregation, politics, technology. Follow Dave Weiner. Follow news. Get news that's not delivered to you through a corporate talking head. I'm not going to say it's necessarily better, but once you start reading international news to see what's important in international news, and you compare that to what's on the front page of CNN, you begin to see a very different view of the world, and I think that's informative. Whether you agree with it or not is irrelevant. The idea is that it should challenge your thinking. And then follow some political blogs, follow somebody who's not thinking the same way you are. Follow somebody that you hate to read because you hate what they say. Follow, read them, see what they say. And then examine, take the metacognitive step back and say, why do I hate what they're saying? I mean, we have alleged freedom of speech in this country. There are some limitations on it, but thanks to the Patriot Act, but we should at least listen to what people are saying that we don't agree with so that we can examine why it is that we don't agree with them. And then think about it. And then get a blog and write about it. And eventually, somebody will notice. In fact, tell people. Comment on other people's blogs. If you comment on Will Richardson's blog, 9 times out of 10, he will comment on yours. Well, I don't know, 9 times out of 10. He's getting awful big these days. Maybe 3 times out of 10. I don't know.
Sure.
I do know that I assign my students. I teach a master's course in distance education. I assign my students to get an aggregator and a blog and to write about their experiences, but also to write about what it is they find. And if you ping back Stephen Downs, you will quite often will get an answer back from Stephen Downs. It's really interesting how small this community really is, even when you start getting overwhelmed by the size and scope of it.
And so let me ask you a question as a result of that. You say this is a small community. Is the online community one community?
Oh, now that's a really good question. That's a really good question. You and I, are we both on Classroom 2.0 on Ning?
We are.
We are. I don't think even Classroom 2.0 is one community.
Why not?
Well, let's do an analogy. Classroom 2.0 is a city. There are a lot of people who share residence in this city, but we don't happen to bump up against each other. You live on the north side, I live on the south side. You go to your set of stores, I go to my set of stores. You go out to dinner here, I go out to dinner there. Once in a while, we'll meet downtown. I'll run into you on my way to coffee because I got an appointment someplace. We have only that accidental integration. In terms of physical community, and I owe Downs for this. He was the one who really helped me understand the nature of traditional community. Your community is where you live. In traditional sense, your community is where you live. That is, it's the people who live around you, perhaps on your block, in your neighborhood. It's the people that you run into at the stores that you frequent. It's the folks that you see at the restaurants. It's the people that you meet in your school. It's the people who share an accidental propinquity, that is, you're near them. Now, in any neighborhood, you may agree with the person who lives across the hall, but completely disagree with the person who lives in the building behind you. So, but you're still in the same community. So it really, in a physical, traditional sense, community really has nothing to do with how you think. It has to do with where you live. We take that on, to go back to your original question, is online a single community? No, because we aren't, first, we don't all share this propinquity. We don't share this accidental nearness. There's, what did I just see? 12,000 members of Classroom 2.0. From a certain extent, yeah, we're the same. From a certain perspective, we're in the same community in the sense that we might live in the same town. In another sense, if we're not responding to the "I want to use blog and wiki in my classroom, where do I start?" questions that occur about every third day, we're not participating in that community, the community of helping the newcomer who's coming on board for the first time community. We're not working in that group. Now, there are some places where I do actually still continue to participate in that community, although I've had to take kind of a step back from that because I've started getting a little impatient with a perception that I have that teachers in particular are unwilling to do their own homework. I'm not sure that's a fair characterization, and I'm very careful about how I say that. But I don't participate in that community. I do participate in some of the open source community. I do participate in some of the questions about Linux. I participate in some of, particularly the questions about podcasting. There are so many misconceptions about podcasting that I really feel a need to participate in there. For philosophical discussions, I actually participate in a completely different Ning. I participate at Fireside Learning Ning. And even there, I don't participate in, for example, there's a book reading group. I don't read. I do read, I just don't read those books. I don't have time to read that book. I don't have that kind of time commitment to be able to deal with that. So I think the idea of traditional community is really based not on what we think, but on where we live. And to a certain extent, that extends into the online environment, because if you're trying to communicate with somebody who is not in your Ning, you need to go to their Ning in order to talk to them. If you're talking to somebody in Twitter, it doesn't matter how much time you spend in Ning, you're never going to communicate with them in that other community. But I think online has given us the opportunity to start dealing with something, to come up with kind of a new definition of community. The idea that, and perhaps this is what the definition of network is, we have a voluntary alignment of ideals. We have a voluntary alignment with people that we like, respect, follow, listen to, perhaps don't like, but I think there's a certain sense of we're all engaged in this together. There's a sense that we're all asking similar questions and all looking for similar answers, which goes back to another part of your presentation, that I believe the fact that it is in flux, the fact that what online provides us with is the opportunity to change that affinity group, whatever you want to call it, network, community, whatever. We can change that affinity group depending on literally our whim at the moment. And I don't believe that that changes the validity or the value of that in terms of whether we want to call it a community or a network or whatever. The idea that we now have the ability to move, because remember, going back to the physical, our community is where we live. I can't just say, well, this afternoon I'm going to go live on the south side of town because I want to talk to the people who are there. I can go to the south side of town, but until I live there, I don't really have any idea of what it's like to be there. I'm just a tourist. So the idea that it's in flux online, I don't think is a negative. I don't think it constitutes a shift in what makes community. I think what it provides for us is a richer definition of where it is we live. In physical space, we can only live in one place at a time. In virtual space, we can live in a variety of places all at the same time. And I think that provides a very interesting take on the concept of community.
Yeah, I agree with you. So, gosh, I'd really like to unpack the teachers don't do their own homework thing, but I think I should save that for another time. Actually, the podcasting one would be fun too, because I know you have some good thoughts on that. Go ahead.
There's a saying I have. We've got all the magic bullets that we need. What we don't have is a magic gun.
That's well said. It's very well said. So let me come back to the nature of learning and being a teacher then and being in a classroom. I know there are some teachers out there who are trying to help their students create sort of some personal network environments. There are teachers who would claim that they learn best in personal learning networks. I think I'm one of those teachers. I learn more when I can have some involvement in how I make my connections and what I connect to. How do you teach in an environment where your kids' content, the people and the ideas and the things that they are reading, or how do you learn in an environment where your stuff and the stuff that you are co-learning or the stuff that the people you are co-learning with is different stuff? Right, there's some overlap in those contexts, but there's a lot of difference. What do we do about teaching and learning in that sort of an environment?
Well, I think the first thing is really a mindset change. The first thing to remember is that this idea of you're all teaching and learning the same thing at the same time is bogus to begin with. That doesn't exist. That doesn't happen. It happens only in the mind of the teacher. Mm-hmm. When you stand up in front of a classroom and you present a lesson, does every student in that class learn the same lesson? Of course not.
Right.
Of over the course of a day, does every student in that class leave that classroom and learn everything? Of course, I think this whole idea of there is just some sort of monolithic, megalithic idea of we're all learning the same thing, how do we learn when everybody's learning something different? It already exists. Everybody is already learning something different. So really, we have to get over that idea to begin with. We start there. And then we have to figure out, how do we create spaces? How do we create experiences that provide an overlap? To go back to this idea of context, how do we provide an overlapping context in people so that they can share resources, ideas, viewpoints, perspectives, their context and cognates in a way that helps everybody's context grow? And I think that's the question that you really want to be getting at.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how does a teacher teach a student to learn in this kind of environment? I think the first thing the teacher has to do is learn how to learn in that environment, which goes back to my earlier statement about teachers not wanting to do their homework. One of the challenges and one of the questions, one of the things that bugs me about Classroom 2.0 is that 90% of the questions the teachers ask in Classroom 2.0 could be answered by the teacher themselves if they would take a week, part-time, a weekend even. You know, how do I use a blog? How do I use a wiki in class? Why don't you start a blog and a wiki and see how you would use it, see how it works, see how you use it for whatever purpose that you might have. The advice that I give to my students is use the tool to manage your learning. Well, I'm a teacher. I'm not learning. That's your first problem.
Ooh, yeah.
I'm not trying to learn here. I'm trying to teach. It's, well, you're trying to learn how to use a blog and a wiki. So there's your first issue. Use the blogs, use the wikis, use the tools to manage your own learning. And once you've done that, then you're in a better position to determine how you might advise people to use it in their learning. Now, my lessons, my advice are based on, at this point, about 5 years of using these tools online. I've been involved in technology for going on 40 years now. I built my first computer as a junior high school science fair project 40-something years ago. I have been doing this for a very, very, very long time. The whole notion of digital immigrant is ludicrous to me. I'm a digital aboriginal. So the idea here is that teaching, for all that we want to make it science, I maintain that teaching is art. Teaching is an art form. Teaching is not factory production. One of the challenges with it is that we're trying to produce not the same product, not the same outcome in every student, but a different outcome in every student. And the current political climate that says everybody has to learn the same thing at the same time in the same way, even when you drop the same way, everybody has to learn everything at the same time, is ludicrous, because everybody isn't learning everything at the same time. Even in the best of circumstances, everybody isn't learning everything at the same time. What we're basically talking about is the lowest common denominator. We want everybody to learn at least this at the same time. And even that is not necessarily a very good measurement for people who aren't ready to read, people who aren't ready to do arithmetic, people who aren't ready for algebra, people who aren't ready for geometry, people who aren't ready for science. So we've got some issues there. And I'm rambling and I've completely lost my train of thought.
No, that's fine. I think you answered the question. Let me ask you one based on my experience.
Let me go back to art.
Yeah, teaching is an art.
Teaching is an art. An artist needs to know a medium before they can incorporate it in their art. So what happens is an artist will play with paint. They will play with a palette. They will play with different ways of applying paint. They will play with different patterns and structures. They will play with their tools and explore what their tools can do long before they try to create art using those tools. A writer will experiment in different forms. A writer will use different kinds of language or genres. A writer will play in different places before they try to create art, before they try to put out a message. I think teachers approach this much too much like cooks and not enough like chefs. That it's one thing to create a recipe and that following a recipe will result in some sort of regular outcome, assuming, of course, that you have regular ingredients. Anybody who's tried to do bread understands the difference in ingredients when it comes to flour. The variation in students is much greater than that in flour. It's very difficult to come up with a uniform outcome when doing something simple like following a bread recipe. The idea that a scientific recipe for education will result in a uniform set of learning outcomes strikes me, it just seems to me as being so totally counterproductive as to be almost ludicrous. And part of that comes back to teachers learning their tools before they try to use those tools in creation of their art, in the exercise of their art, which for teachers is education.
Do you think that online learning is making it easier to point out some of these really old problems with teaching and learning, or not problems necessarily, but descriptions? I mean, the reason why I fell into blogging as a teacher is that it helped me as a writer do the things that I was trying to teach my students to do with writing. The idea that there are connections to other writers and other writing and other ideas, I could literally show them those connections by making a hyperlink in a way that I never could by holding two books up and saying, these are related and important. Do you think the same is true of learning environments and what they can teach us about online learning environments and what they can teach us about offline learning environments? Is there something to the fact that everything exists as a tangible thing online that we can manipulate and play with? And is that useful?
Oh, I think so. I think that's a really good point. I think in a lot of sense, because I teach my students in the master's program are generally speaking are classroom teachers. They're K-12 teachers looking to get their master's. One of the interesting things that for me it's interesting. I don't know if it's interesting for them. Are you familiar with the purpose of science fiction? Science fiction, the purpose of science fiction is to cast light on the human condition by exploring conditions that are not human, or at least not currently human.
Right, right.
One of the advantages that online gives me is the opportunity to look at education in juxtaposition to how is it different if I offer it online or in a class. It gives me that same kind of comparative to say, okay, how is this different from what we're doing in the classroom? And of course, everybody thinks that it's completely different. And the reality is it isn't different at all. It's only a question of which technologies we pick. I mean, I've said forever, in fact, you've probably read it more than once, that all education is at a distance. As soon as you have a teacher and a student, they are automatically separated by some amount of time and space. Even if it's only 1 foot and a fraction of a second, even if the only technology you use to bridge the gap between the teacher and the learner is spoken language, that's still a technology. So when we start arguing that distance education is education in an environment where technology is used to mediate communication between the teacher and the learner, well, that's a classroom. There's nothing diagnostic about any of the definitions of distance education that differentiate distance education from classroom education. Any definition is applicable in both cases. If the same is applicable in both cases, then really what we're talking about is what choices do we make in terms of technology selection in any particular environment, in any particular, to go back to this word, context, in order to generate and deliver the kinds of messages that we want to generate and deliver. So I think the value of distance education in part is an opportunity to examine non-distance education from a perspective that is, for most people, totally foreign. I do like your idea that it does provide us with a much more immediate way of showing connection. My Phaedrus posts are always, almost always, a quick blurb explaining why I think this paragraph is important, a link to somebody else's post, and then a follow-up on why, what I found significant about the whole experience. And then quite frequently, I'll ask my students a question to follow up with. So, yeah, I think it makes it easier to show connection. I think it makes it easier to show similarity. I think it gives us an opportunity to look at education in a general form that's not biased by being in the space. That is, we can look at education, and we can look at classroom education because we have a juxtaposition when we go online.
You mentioned science fiction, and I was wondering if I was going to ask you this question, and I'm going to ask it, and you don't have to answer it.
You're going to have to repeat that.
Go ahead. You mentioned science fiction, and so I feel comfortable asking this question, and if you don't want to answer it, that's fine. But I very much enjoy your books, your fiction, and I get the sense, and I might be reading way too much into this, but a lot of what you write about Ishmael Wong specifically, and the oh rats, are you still there? Do I still have you, Nathan?
Last thing I heard was a lot of what you write about.
Gotcha. I wonder if a lot of what you write about, whether you mean to or not, is the process of education. There's a great deal of schooling and learning going on in your books, and I wonder is that intentional on your part, or is that just something you have a lot of experience with?
Yeah, it is actually. It's actually intentional. Okay, I can't. You keep breaking up. I can't tell if you've done.
I'm here. I'm here.
One of the things that I wanted to write about, and one of the reasons that I did not write the Ishmael Goes to College book, at least not yet, was that one of the things that I wanted to do in this book was to explore the ways that people might, sometime in the future, get their, for lack of a better term, education. Ishmael is a big in the beginning of the first book, there's a big frou-frou about how Ishmael is going to go to the local university and how his mother was a college professor. So there are universities, there are colleges. In fact, he does go to the academy to learn to be an officer. But along the way, you hear that he has gone to school at the university enclave. But you also learn in other books that there are places where people don't go to school at all, that there are, in fact, no schools. Ishmael learns what he needs to learn on the job. There is a whole system in place for the people engaged in the activities of the novels, where when you're a crewman on board one of these freighters, there's a whole set of rules, there's a whole set of tests, there's a whole set of learning, there's a whole set of instructional materials. And if you pass the test, you get the rating. If you get the rating, you get the certification, and you can hold a new job. And if that was really a commentary on what I see as a tendency for us to be viewing education not as a pursuit of scholarship, but as a pursuit of credential. It was perhaps a bit cynical view of my take that education is a pursuit of credential. I'm actually, maybe shouldn't confess this, but I'm actually quite bitter that with a PhD in educational technology, I cannot get permission to take the exam to sit for a K-12 teacher's license in any state in the country. I need to take another 2 years of instruction, and in some cases, actually take the courses that I have taught in order for them to appear on my transcript so that I can qualify to take the licensure exam. This is, It's not like I'm actually going to do it, but when we start talking about educational reform and we're taking people in an educational situation, you know, I've had methods courses. I've taught the pre-service technology courses that they're going to require me to take. There is a problem in our system wherein the shortcut is actually longer and more expensive than the traditional mode. Right now, it would be cheaper and faster for me to get a Bachelor of Science in biology education than it would be for me to take the fast track certification route in the state of Colorado. There's something wrong with that. I mean, yeah, I'm a little bit bitter. It's not like I'm really gonna do it, but this whole idea that we're focused on education, we want new ideas, we want new people to come into the field, we want to encourage folks. And then to look at the system and the process wherein what really matters is your certification, what really matters is your credential. It doesn't really matter what you know. It doesn't really matter what your skill level might be. But what matters is what credential you have. It's the same way with college. You can't teach in college without a terminal degree. I got my PhD so that I could teach in college. It was actually easier than it was to get a K-12 license, which is great for me because PhDs probably earn a little bit more. But it underscores a problem with the way education is approached, in particularly in the U.S. today. So yeah, I wrote these books in a way that what we focused on was credential, because really when you look at what education is today, what we're doing is credentialing. And what happens when you teach, in particular on the job stuff like this, and in the future, in my future college school, that stuff doesn't go away. But what happened is that this parallel idea of certification has risen to the forefront in many cases, in many circumstances. There's a precursor to that today. If you want to be a network engineer these days, you're best Novell or Microsoft Network Engineer certified. You don't do that in school. You do that by getting their learning materials, reading up, taking the test, flunking the test, reading some more, going back and taking the test again. And so there's an argument for the credential is already independent of school. It's already independent of education. You could be a lawyer today by passing the bar exam. You don't have to go to law school in order to be a lawyer. So there's some interesting parallels. But yes, you're the first one who's actually mentioned that. But there is a great deal of commentary on education, the educational process, and what it takes and what it means to become educated. One of the ongoing one of the ranks in there is Ishmael's comment of the value of a liberal arts education. Even though he doesn't have a liberal arts education, his mother was a professor of ancient literature who studied, the really ancient people like Shakespeare, but also the ancients from the latter half of the 20th century. So it was pretty interesting. It was a lot of fun for me to weave this whole subplot about education and credentialing into the books.
Yeah, I thought it was really hopeful, actually, because the ability for Ishmael to access the information he needed to get the credential he needed was not only expected. I mean, it was sort of like it was built into the culture of the system. And I thought that was, while it's cynical to say you got to have the cert, getting the cert was not this laborious process. It was very straightforward, and people were employed specifically to help him get them.
Exactly,
Yeah.
exactly. And to get them in ways that were not expensive, difficult, or otherwise outside of the normal purview of what his day-to-day life was. Now, in part, I was able to do that because the canned environment of being aboard ship for weeks and weeks at a time makes that almost obligatory. That's actually that whole thing, that whole instructional take the test, get the rating, do the thing. It's actually modeled on what happens in the U.S. military today. I remember doing these tests when I was in the Coast Guard in order to get my rating exams. They weren't quite as easy. They weren't delivered to you without asking. You had to go track them down, find them, have them shipped to you, meet them when they physically arrived. But in the early 70s, there are our ability for ubiquitous access was somewhat limited.
Yeah, right. And the longer I have my iPhone handy, I feel more and more like I've got that tablet that everybody carried, and there was even a pocket built right into the uniform to carry. I find that really fascinating. So I'm glad I got the opportunity to ask that question. I've taken a lot of your time and have learned a great deal. In fact, I'm looking forward to listening back to this a lot. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the topic or mention before we go?
Let me look. I think we've pretty much covered it. The idea of the lie, the way things are arranged, I think that's an important construct. I like the way that has been woven in. And I like the fact that this really is a conversation. I work a lot with Don Little at Syracuse University, and one of the things that we often ponder is, particularly in education, we're really anxious to find out what the answers are, but I'm not even sure we know what the questions are yet. So, you know, the interesting issue for me isn't what's a good answer. The interesting question for me is, what's a good question? And I think this idea of having a conversation of what is community, what is network, how does it work, how does it relate to us? I think even from my advanced age and experience, my gray hair and advanced degree, or perhaps because of my gray hair and advanced degree, this whole notion of network, I'm not convinced we have any answers. I'm not convinced we really have any questions yet. What we have is an opportunity for an experience. And my encouragement is to go back and remember that education is an art, and that everything that we have to pull from is another tool in our toolbox. It's important to look at things like textbooks not as a single medium, but as blended media. Textbooks incorporate words, but they also have pictures. Textbooks are therefore multimedia. They also provide an opportunity for random access. You can open a textbook anywhere in the middle. The idea that a textbook, that any text, is actually a linear medium is somewhat misguided, particularly in the physical plane. You know, we hear a lot about how online gives us the opportunity for random access, but textbooks are random access. I can open to chapter 12. I can read chapter 12. It might not mean as much to me if I haven't read chapter 11, but I can reach. To start asking the questions about why. The idea that I tell my students question everything, including me, drives them crazy because they want to think that there must be some solid answers. There must be some solid ground. I'm not convinced that there is. I'm not convinced that there isn't. But so far, I haven't seen it. Like I said before, we've got a lot of magic bullets, but we don't have any magic guns.
Well, Nathan, I very much appreciate your time and your teaching. You've been my teacher for a few years now.
And thanks for having me on here.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very welcome.
We'll have to do it when we have a better connection.
Yes, we should. We should.